are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Question Reality. I'm your host, Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Studio City, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you question your career reality. This show is for you if you were, are, or might be considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guest will provide advice, resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. Our guests work in various professions of entertainment, so that means that we will definitely have someone on the show sooner or later from a career that you are interested in. And if you want to check out any of our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, then you want to go to the LA Talk Radio website, latalkradio.com. You're on there now if you're listening to us. So you want to go click the link at the top of this website that says Channel 1. You scroll down, look for the graphic of our show, which is Question Reality, and you click the link. And this takes you directly to the archive page where you can view view the list of past guests. And our shows are also available for download on iTunes under the podcast section. You just type in Question Reality Radio in the search box. And if you want to find out about future guests, you want to go to our official Question Reality website, and that is questionrealityshow.com, questionrealityshow.com. And we are booked. Our show has become so popular. Oh my goodness, I'm so happy. We are booked all the way until, oh man, it's May, June, and then we have one person coming on in July. So thank you guys for making our show so popular. We got people lined up, but thank you again, everybody, for listening, and thank you for your emails, and my goodness, the word is spread, and we're getting calls and emails from all over the world, and I love it. So many people are being helped, and I've gotten emails from people who actually have moved from other countries. They were so inspired by the guests that have come on the show and told them how they need to do it, how to move here and how to get a job and what jobs they can get. And it's just been really wonderful how many lives that we have touched. So I'm excited. That's what it's all about for me. So today we have a returning guest, and his name is Brad Mays, and he has brought his wonderful wife with us today. Her name is Lorinda Starfelt, and he was a guest, if you remember, on our show last year, June 27th, and we got so many emails about him, how helpful he was. We decided to bring him back on, and he is going to be talking to us today about his recent projects, and also he's going to be telling us some tips and advice on how to get involved in working in that world, and hopefully Lorinda can give you some tips too. But first, I want to tell you guys about some upcoming things and things that I just really think that you should know about. Now, normally, you know, I do advertisements for various casting workshops and classes and stuff, and I'm hoping to get one in today, but I wanted to really get this out today. I want to ask for your help for a former guest that was recently on the show, Laquita Cleary. She's a producer, actress, writer, and she's currently working on producing an amazing short. It's a passion project of hers on a very serious issue. It's about a woman who loses her son in a drunk driving accident, and she goes to confront the man who is responsible for this. And Laquita is trying to get the word out and raise funds for this project. If you want to help, people can get involved for as little as $10 and get different perks on the level of giving. So if you could do me a favor and go to the website and donate, or if you don't have any money to donate, just copy the website link and then send it in an email to your family and friends. It would be so greatly appreciated, because as you know, there can just never be enough reminders of why you shouldn't drink and drive. So I think we should do our part and keep the message going and maybe be a part of saving a life. So let me give you that website address. It's indiegogo.com, IndieGogo.com. Again, IndieGogo.com. And you want to put a / and put fragment, FRAGMENT, which is the name of this project. So again, please go donate if you can. If you can't, copy that link, send it out in a mass email, and let's get another reminder movie out there, okay? Now, I don't have a habit of passing out these little internet stories because, you know, we all get them. Most of the time I delete them. I just don't even pass them on because I know I hate getting them. But I tell you, this one was so funny that I had tears coming out of my eyes, and it was the best laugh I had in a while. And I think that I sent it out to a couple people, and they sent it out to their friends. And the next thing you know, I get an email from a friend saying, you know what, you should read this on your show, because you obviously, if people are listening to your show, they share the same humor that you do. So I thought, what the hell? I'm going to go ahead and do it. So let's take a minute to really listen, because you really have to be, I thought you had to be a little bit of an intellectual to get this, but if you listen carefully, you'll get it. So the following, it's an actual question given on a University of Arizona chemistry midterm, and an actual answer turned in by a student. And the answer by one student was so profound that the professor decided to share it with his colleagues via the internet, which is, of course, how we now are going to have the pleasure of enjoying it as well. So this was a bonus question. And the bonus question was, is hell exothermic, which means gives off heat, or endothermic, which absorbs heat? And most of the students, what they did was they wrote proofs of their beliefs using Boyle's law, which is gas cools when it expands and heat when it's compressed, or some variant of that. But one student, however, wrote the following. Okay, he said, first, we need to know how the mass of hell is changing in time. So we need to know the rate at which souls are moving into hell and the rate at which they are leaving, which is unlikely. I think that we can safely assume that once a soul gets to hell, it will not leave. Therefore, no souls are leaving. As for how many souls are entering hell, let's look at different religions that exist in the world today. Most of these religions state that if you are not a member of their religion, you will go to hell. Since there is more than one of these religions, and since people do not belong to more than one religion, we can project that all souls go to hell. With birth and death rates as they are, we can expect the number of souls in hell to increase exponentially. Now, let's look at the rate of change of the volume in hell, because Boyle's law states that in order for the temperature and pressure in hell to stay the same, the volume of hell has to expand proportionately as souls are added. This gives us two possibilities. Number one, if hell is expanding at a slower rate than the rate at which souls enter hell, then the temperature and pressure in hell will increase until all hell breaks loose. Number two, if hell is expanding at a rate faster than the increase in souls in hell, then the temperature and pressure will drop until hell freezes over. So which is it? If we accept the postulate given to me by Teresa during my freshman year that it'll be a cold day in hell before I sleep with you, and take into account the fact that I slept with her last night, then number two must be true. And thus, I am sure that hell is exothermic and has already frozen over. The corollary of this theory is that since hell has frozen over, it follows that it is not accepting any more souls and is therefore extinct, leaving only heaven, thereby proving the existence of a divine being, which explains why last night Teresa kept shouting, "Oh my God." Do we not love that? Oh my God, that is just the funniest thing ever. Oh, I laugh so hard. I still get a kick out of that. And of course, the student got an A+. So there you go. Now, let's move on to our guest today. They just both won the California Film Awards Diamond Award for their 2009 film release, The Watermelon. Brad is an award-winning veteran of dozens of stage television and independent film productions spanning like 30 years. And his films include the award-winning A Way Back In, The Mackay, and Stage Fright. And Mr. May's notable stage productions include The Water Hen by Stanislav Ignacy Witkiewicz, which is a mouthful in itself, Dragon Slayers by Stanley Keyes, a multimedia adaptation of A Clockwork Orange, Euripides, The Mackay, again, Peter Weiss, The Persecution and Assassination of Jean-Paul Marat, as performed by the inmates of the asylum of Cheriton under the direction of the Marquis de Sade, Equus, and many others. And currently they are working on a web series called Disservice and a play called Prophecy. So without further ado, let's talk to them now. Hey, Brad! Hey, Lorinda, are you there? Are you sleeping after that long, 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 long joke?
We're here. We're awake.
Oh,
we're very
boy.
Much awake. By the way, that was pretty good. He definitely deserved an A+ for that.
I think so, huh? That was
yeah.
Funny,
I mean, he's really stretching the application of logic there, but I think
yeah,
there's better...
a couple of assumptions that really shouldn't have passed muster. But the conclusion was so stunning that.
Yeah, you weren't expecting it, right? It just came right out. He was just so serious, and he was, like, nailing it. And then all of a sudden, he brings Teresa in on it.
Yeah. I wonder how Teresa felt about that.
I know. I was thinking the same thing. Well, I don't think she's with him now. I don't know where he's going to get his correlations for his next test, my God.
Well, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. What's the phrase?
Never...
She blinded me by science. Or...
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Hey,
science is cool.
Science is cool. As long as you don't blow anything up or set yourself aflame, it's good. Now, a question for you. I know last time you were on the show, you also were about to – there was a new development at that time, and you were going to be directing your first play since 2003. It was the controversial play Prophecy, written by Karen Malpede, and it had just closed in New York. Take us through. What happened? Because now it's done. Or let's talk about that. What happened?
Well, no, it hasn't. Actually, we're just about to start production at this point. Hasn't been done yet. But it's a fascinating piece. It deals. Yeah, Lori, you want to pipe in on this a little bit?
Well, it was an exchange I began on a political website with a political blogger by the name of David Swanson, who writes about peace issues. And he wrote about Prophecy, and he was looking for maybe somebody who could stage it in Washington, D.C. And I wrote, and I said, I'm not in Washington, D.C., but I'm in Los Angeles. My husband is, you know, an established director, and I'd certainly be interested in taking a look at this. So he sent the play over. Brad read it before I did it and was just like, holy cow, this is some kind of piece of work. And, you know, it got a lot of attention in New York. It got a lot of it had run in London. It had gotten attention from people like Vanessa Redgrave and the National Theater over there, but that didn't work out. But so now we were staging it. Now we're talking about staging it here in L.A., and we've just moved forward. We've met with Ms. Malpede and her husband, George, I forgot his last name. He's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And, you know, we had a real meeting of the minds, and we've decided, you know, the only kind of art that I'm interested in pursuing is art that I can sink my teeth into and just pursue with all the heart and soul and ambition and drive they've got. I don't ever want to have hesitations about a project that I'm associated with, you know. I just want to feel good, good, good. I want to be able to pitch it to anybody, you know. And when we read the play, it was clearly a play that functioned at that kind of level. And so, you know, Brad, Karen, George, and I got together, and the meeting went great. We were each who the other was hoping we'd be. And so we decided to move forward on production. We had our first table read a couple weeks ago, and that went pretty well. You know, we haven't finished casting or anything like that, but, you know, now we're on to the next stage of production, and Brad is talking to production designers and costumers and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're basically going to use the same design team that worked on the show in New York, and we're going to recast it. We have a woman playing the lead role that I feel very strongly about. Actually, she was involved in the production of A Clockwork Orange I did 8 years ago. Her name is Mary Elizabeth Barrett. Fantastic actress, phenomenal stage actress. And she had a huge scene cut out of There Will Be Blood. She had a scene just between herself and Daniel Day-Lewis. It broke her heart when she saw the film. But she really operates on a very high level.
She's one of those actresses whose natural gift is that she just comes with a tremendous amount of dignity. That's just what she has. You know, she is an extremely fine actress, very well trained, you know, with an enormous amount of talent. And she, no matter who she's playing, she just brings a tremendous amount of dignity to that character. She was playing a homeless woman in A Clockwork Orange, and she elevated that role to just, I mean, she didn't even really have any dialogue. And yet she was an incredible presence on that stage. And so it's really great to get to work with an actress like that in a role like this, where she really gets to bring the full force of her own natural gifts as well as all of her training to the table, you know, and let all of us share in that.
Yeah, she's also fearless. She was double or triple cast in The Clockwork Orange. She also played the scene with the writer when Alex and his droogs come in and beat the writer and rape his wife. She played the wife in that scene. And I threw a lot at her in that scene. I'm not going to go into detail, but it was pretty heavy. It was excruciating, I think, to watch. And she handled it all. She's great. She's brilliant. And
where is this wonderful play going to take place so we can keep an eye out for it?
Well, we're talking with several theaters right now. It's just a matter of being able to get the play booked into a theater in the time frame that we're looking at. Our first choice is the Coast Playhouse, but there are several other theaters that we're talking to. We want to be very careful about what venue we choose because it's an important play. And it's a kind of play that requires, I believe, a very dignified and really very, very professional approach.
I like that you just said that, and I want you to expand on that, because tell us how important, I'm so glad you brought that up, tell us how important it is in choosing a theater, and what does one look for if they're about to put on their first play? How do they know where to choose a theater? Because obviously different types of people go to different theaters in different areas. How do you, if you're a first-time director doing a play, how do you choose it? What do you do? I mean, it's so overwhelming with all the theaters. Give us some clues as to how to pick that theater.
Well, there's a saying that I sort of copped from an independent filmmaker named Lenny Lipton. He wrote a book back in the very late 60s, early 70s called Independent Filmmaking. And he's also the guy who wrote Puff the Magic Dragon. You may recall that song. he also had a column with the Berkeley Barb in San Francisco. He came up with a phrase in the book Independent Filmmaking that I find very useful. Quality is relative to purpose. Now, if you're choosing a theater for a piece, you first have to decide, you know, what is the piece that you're doing? I mean, what is it really? The odds are pretty good in this town that if you're a useful, you said a beginning director, let's not limit it to that. Let's say one possibility is you want to do a play so that you can showcase your talents and the talents of the actors involved. That's a very common thing in Los Angeles. They call them industry showcases, and they'll put on a play and they'll invite the industry. They'll invite agents and managers and casting people, that type of thing. In which case, you know, you're not necessarily going for something definitive. What you're going for is a showcase, you know, and your run is, you know, the amount of performances you're likely to be doing are likely to be rather limited, not a 10-week run or anything like that. Of course, we all hope that a production will be a hit. But in a case like that, there are a lot of theaters that house, I don't know, anywhere between 35 and 60, you know, audience members per night. The contract that you use with Actors Equity for these is called the 99-seat contract. But mostly, the venues for something like that don't actually have 99 seats. It's fewer than 99 seats. And you're limited in the number of lighting instruments that you have. You might wind up with anywhere between 10 and maybe 18 lighting instruments. There are lots of technical limitations into what you can do. And usually the theaters, you're not just booking them for the week. You're booking them for the time that your performance is going on. So they're also going to be having acting classes during the day, and you're sort of scheduled for the nights that you're performing. So your set has to be strikeable. You have to be able to tear it down and so on and so forth. So that's sort of at the low end of what you might wind up doing. And then at the higher end, there are theaters like the Coast Playhouse that have a full 99 seats. They have a magnificent, you know, lighting board and all the instruments that you would ever need for a stage that size. They're much more costly, you know, renting a place like the Coast Playhouse. It's certainly not cheap, but you get what you pay for. And okay, any production that's going on in a space like that, any self-produced production, which is what ours is, it's independently financed and self-produced. It's not affiliated with any kind of theater company or acting company or anything like that. The audiences will know going in that this is a serious production. And the reason I feel that I want to do it at a venue like that to do Prophecy there is that there really are no – this is not the kind of play where there are conceptual tricks or hooks. This is a drama that is very much to be taken at face value. And it's a piece that is dangerous. It deals with the political tension between Israel and the Palestine nation, and it does it in a way that's very unique. And it's very humanistic. It comes very much on the side of humanity. It is not didactic. It doesn't take one side or the other. It doesn't try to preach any kind of political lesson. It just takes the situation as it is, as a whole, and then extrapolates it. It imposes or superimposes this political situation, this horrible political situation, into a family kind of drama. Without going into too much detail, the play deals with the survival of this family.
Let me ask you something. This seems like a really heavy play in terms of L.A. Now, in New York, and I don't want to be biased, but I'm from the East Coast, so I think, in my opinion, in personal opinion, I think that you could find hundreds of actors that could come and audition, and I think a multiple number of them could nail these parts that are very serious. I find from personal experience in directing a couple plays out here myself, that if I were to try to do a play like that, I would have to have several auditions. What is your thought on the actors? Do you find it hard doing plays with that content? Do you find it harder to have auditions where you find people that you feel are capable of carrying those heavy roles?
Let me ask you a simple question first. If you're an actor who's really, really, really good at what you do and you want to earn a living acting, where do you want to be, New York or Los Angeles? Where do
Personally,
you have a better...
Exactly.
No, earn a living. Earn a living. That's the standard. Mm. You want to earn a living acting.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You're going to be in L.A. Now, mm-hmm. Brad can talk to you about this in detail, but I want to talk about Kat because he's worked in both New York and Los Angeles, so he can address this directly. But let me say this. One of the things I see in L.A. is that there is very little encouragement to actually read actors' resumes. Very little. When we're casting, I look at an actor's resume before I look at their headshot. And I'm looking for an actor with substantial credits. And once I weed out the actors with insubstantial credits, I'm going to have a stack a mile high of actors with credits that range from Los Angeles to Moscow to Italy to New York to China to L.A., who've worked with the great directors of the world. The thing I see in Los Angeles is a lot of badly placed casting notices and that don't really work to filter out inexperienced actors because there are a lot of people in L.A. seeking celebrity, and they don't know the difference between being a good actor and being a good celebrity. So the first thing you have to do when you go into a casting process is decide how you're going to define it for the LA market. And then once you do that successfully, you're going to weed out. I mean, we put classically trained in almost all of our ads because that scares the heck out of most people who don't know what it means. You know, I don't necessarily need a classically trained actor,
right?
But that's what I put in there. And
great
so they
idea.
Just don't bother to show up. And, you know, we'll put nudity required in at a drop of a hat just because that also scares off an experienced actor.
Well, I mean, let's put that into some kind of context. We did a production of The Bacchae in Los Angeles in 1997 where there was a lot of nudity on stage. And we put full frontal nudity required in the casting notices. And interestingly, we got a lot of responses from some women. The nudity was for the Bacchae themselves, the holy man. It's we made that clear. We got a lot of responses from some women who were clearly exhibitionistic and that type of thing. And we weren't interested in people like that. We were interested in people who were nervous about the nudity, who understood that this was a risky proposition, and that the only reason to do it would be in the service of something that had a project that had aesthetic value, that had cultural value, which, you know, the Bacchae, it's Euripides, it's ancient Greek theater. It's like doing the Bible. You know, you're dealing with themes that go way beyond questions of propriety or good or bad taste. And even to the extent that, you know, when we would be we were fairly long in the casting process for this, the question that we wound up being asked toward the end of these interviews was, but it's going to be in good taste, right? And my answer was, no, it's not going to be in good taste. This is the Bacchae. This is Euripides. This is beyond questions of good taste. This is a holy rite. You know, this is serious stuff. This is the human experience. This isn't, it's so far beyond questions of propriety that asking whether it's in good or bad taste is entirely missing the point.
Right.
Especially when you're looking at a culture like the American culture, where good taste seems to be Disney films with elephants wearing tutus dancing to Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. If that's good taste, then the Bacchae is in the worst imaginable taste. However, Euripides, the Bacchae, Shakespeare. These are essential, indispensable cultural artifacts that if you take them at face value, if you confront them head on, you know, sometimes you have to deal with issues like sexuality, sadism, nudity, you know. It's all an integral part of the production. In the Bacchae, we had a concept for the piece that required the nudity. It was an integral part of the imagery for the production. Now, not every play you do is going to have that type of requirement.
Of course.
In doing Karen Malpighi's play Prophecy, you know, one of the things we want to do is avoid a production with heavy conceptual hooks like we used in the Bacchae, and do something that is a very, very straightforward, unadorned piece in which just the drama as written is allowed to step into the fore in an uncluttered and unobfuscated way. So it requires a different kind of approach altogether.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I know, of course, you're going to take it very seriously and you're going to achieve whatever vision that you have. And I know that more people should take their art seriously like you do. So I really appreciate that. But I want to talk about your web series. And the reason I want to talk about that is I got an email the last time, and I'm carrying this email over from last year. I don't know if the person found this out on their own or not, but we had briefly talked about you going to be doing a web series, Featherweight. I don't know if that's still in the process of happening or happened or whatever it happened. But the person said that they're just overwhelmed by all of the new media, all the new things that are happening, like the mobisodes, the webisodes, all these things. Now, it's fascinating to me that a person who takes theater as seriously as you, because it is a beautiful art form and you should take it serious. I don't believe you should do it unless you do. But for you to be able to acclimate to this new medium, you know, web series and or mobisodes, tell me, one, how hard is it to go? Can every theater director do it if they want to get their toe wet? One, if so, are there going to be major mentality changes? And three, I don't know what number I'm on, but tell us how one goes about doing a web series, because it is still baffling to a lot of people. How do you get it up? How is it different from doing a play? I hope you remember all those questions. Go.
Lori's the person to answer that stuff.
Okay, let's do it, Lori. Let's do it.
Well, I want to say the thing that happened with customer disservice that I start off is something that ties in to a question you asked, Brad, about directors staging their first play. When we went to do customer disservice, the first thing to look at, as it would be for a director staging his first play and looking at venues, is what can we afford? With customer disservice, it was a real no-budget piece. And with a beginning director, it's likely to be a low-budget piece. So I wanted to say, when you're a beginning director doing your first play, the first thing you look at is how much money can you conceivably put together, how much you're going to need for your insurance policy, how much you're going to, you know, need for costuming, and then with a few other things, most of the rest of it goes into the theater, and that's how you figure out what theater you're going to rent, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm.
With customer disservice, what that translates into is, because we were doing it no budget, and we're working with these two producers who wrote the entire piece, what they had to put together was something that could be shot in somebody's house that we knew, with actors that they knew, using basically clothes that they already owned. That was the fundamental requirement. And Ron and Scott did that brilliantly. For the director, it's a matter of, well, Brad really needs to address this. You know, staging, I think, is where a lot of theater directors get hung up when moving into film. What theater directors bring to cinematic productions is, you know, an ability to really understand and execute text and to work with actors. But for the rest of it, I think Brad ought to address it.
Well, let's see. The two producers of Customer Disservice, Ron Williams and Scott Weisenfeld, they're writing partners. They've been working together for a long time, and they like many writers, writer-producers, they've been having a lot of difficulty getting projects off the ground. You know, finances, especially in the last 2 years, have just been so grim. So they wrote a piece that they thought would be easy to do. They were very smart in that they wanted to keep each episode short and to the point, punch up the comedy as much as possible, really work the script. They have a very clear idea,
yeah,
a very simple idea about what they wanted to do. When they had their scripts in place, the next thing they did was go out and secure the participation of two marvelous, professional, highly professional comic actors.
Who were friends of theirs.
Well, they happen to be friends of theirs, but the main thing is they're very, very professional in what they do. A guy named Frank Noon and Johnny D'Agostino. And then we all got together for a table read. We just got together very loosely at our place and went through the first 10 or 12 scripts that they had written for the series. And I made little notes here and there, but basically I decided during the read through several things. One, the scripts were good. They might need a little bit of tweaking here and there, but the scripts were solid. They were funny on their own. The second thing I saw was that these were very, very talented, very professional actors. And essentially what was needed was a director to come in and stage these properly, you know, look for ways of enlarging the various moments in the scripts, but without trying to leave directorial fingerprints all over it. In other words, behave myself.
Yes.
Just accept the fact that I have some really good material here. I've got fabulous actors that on their own are going to just kick the hell out of it, just do a really, really good job. It's my goal to make sure that it's filmed properly, that it'll edit together well, you know, that all the physical possibilities are explored, and that if you know, and that the moments as written can be taken as far as they can be taken. So the next thing we did was we arranged rehearsals at the Debbie Reynolds rehearsal studio, professional rehearsal studio, and we worked for like a day and a half, really, really, really hammering these pieces one after the other, blocking them, making sure that we had a really, you know, some really good physical possibilities. We really explored each episode as fully as we could during the time. That meant that when we finally got together to shoot, and we had our our director of photography, and we had a production designer, and all the other help that we needed. That when we showed up to actually shoot this, that their lines were down, they were ready to go. We had been through the material, so we didn't have to waste time, you know, regrouping on that level. We would essentially just set it up and go through the piece as written and as rehearsed, make some final adjustments and changes, and then start shooting. We were able to get through 10 episodes in 2 days
and
by
now,
doing it that way.
I agree. I really like the organization with that. Now, when you finish shooting, talk to us about, okay, you got your product. Let's go and turn it into a web series. Take us through what does one need to do to turn it into a web series?
Well, post-production, which includes editing and adding music and deciding – you know, you edit the piece itself, you add music, you engage in sound editing and you add titles and everything, but what you also have to do, and this was something that was really, really important for this piece, you have to decide what the presentation itself is going to be. It's one thing to edit, it's one thing to cut it together, you know, it's one thing to butt one shot up against another one and get the pace right and make sure that the jokes all work and everything looks good and the color correct. But it's another thing entirely to exercise showmanship, pizzazz. You know, it has to be a presentation. It has, the music and the images have to pop together in the opening credits. You know, the way it ends has to be distinctive. You have to have a distinctive opening and a distinctive ending, because actually what you're doing, you're presenting a piece for people who are lifelong television watchers. So they expect a presentation to have a certain level of polish, a certain level of pop, you know. I just chalk it up to showmanship. So you have to make sure that all of your post-production elements are very much in place. We got a guy named Barrington Van Kampen to write theme music for the piece. And he would give us little, you know, little moments to pop in, you know, when a gag, you know, occurs and you have a laugh, there might be a little musical thing there that just sort of pops in. But he also wrote the theme music for the beginning and the end. He incidentally did some of the music. He did a very lengthy musical cue for The Watermelon and did a wonderful job. Plus, on The Watermelon, we used a Patsy Cline song. Well, it's a Willie Nelson song that Patsy Cline made famous, called Crazy. And we couldn't afford to use the Patsy Cline recording, so Barrington executed and he arranged and he conducted and produced a copycat version of that piece, note for note reproduction of the Patsy Cline original. So he's somebody that we have some history with, and he did the theme music for the piece. So the editing and the music all have to work together, but and you need good editors. You need somebody who knows what they're doing. And it turns out that I edit all my own stuff, so that keeps costs down.
What do you edit it with? Use Mac, Avid, or Final Cut Pro?
I cut on Final Cut Pro. Cut Pro Studio too.
Okay, so
Pro Studio 2. Everybody, it's a great system. It's wonderful. I love it.
Which one did you say? I'm
Final
sorry.
Cut Pro. It's not Studio 2. It's Studio 3 I'm working on now.
Final Cut Pro.
All right,
so you got it done. Everything's ready to go. There's nothing else that needs to be done. You go, you buy your website domain name. Take us from there.
Well, we had a deal in place before we even started shooting with Stay Tuned TV.
And there are lots of websites who are looking to position themselves as the premier resource for web series that are looking for material. So if you can put together a web series, you can find somebody who will host that for you for free.
What are some of the names? Do you know off the top of your head?
Well, you should talk to no, I don't actually. I know Stay Tuned TV. I did all this research months ago, and now I forgot
it.
I would like to talk about, if you're interested in Priscilla, because web series are perfect for beginning directors, is what it is a beginning director should think about if he wants to do a web series.
That's what I'm trying to get at. I love that.
Okay,
let me talk about
that a little bit.
Yeah.
What you need to look at, the first and foremost thing you need to do is gather a list of your resources. What locations can you use for free? Your mom's house, your dad's business, your grandfather's church, you know, the pizza shop you've been going to every Friday night for 6 years, whatever. Just draw up a list of locations you can use for free.
Churches, pawn shops, bars, whatever.
Whatever. Any place you don't have to go to a bureaucracy to get to yes, that's some place you want to have on your list. And then you want to look at your friends. Ron and Scott were really lucky because they've lived in L.A. for many years and they have a lot of friends who are really, you know, well-known, established actors. So they had it easy there. But do you have any friends that are genuinely gifted actors? Have they been through a theatrical training program at a university? Do they know what they're doing in front of a camera? If the answer to that is yes, talk to them. See what they'd be interested in doing, you know, because they may have a character that they're working on. And when you have an idea of what resources you can get for free, then begin putting your story together. And you're going to write a script for a web series, and so it's going to be 2 to 3 minutes long, which is perfect for a beginner. It's just perfect, you know, and you have to be able to tell that story in a short form very quickly. And then once you've put it a script together that doesn't involve banks, you know, police cars. You can't believe how expensive it is to rent a police car in L.A. It's incredibly expensive to get a police car for a half a day. Don't have it in there. You can't get a hospital. You can't get a school. Leave those things out. Just keep it to things you can get for free. And if you have to spend money on something, spend money on a DP. If you don't know how to shoot, spend money on a DP.
Director of photography.
Yes. And spend money on an editor. Do not get some guy who's looking for footage for his reel because he's not going to be able to fix any of the problems that have come up in your production, which are inevitably going to come up. an experienced DP is going to prevent problems from happening. An editor, an experienced editor, is going to fix problems that did happen.
Including,
that's where your budgets need to go.
Including acting problems, including performance problems.
Yeah.
Wow.
Brad has repaired. We had one movie come in that had the single worst film performance I've ever seen. And Brad pasted his performance together, literally word by word. By the time Brad got done with it, you couldn't tell that he was the worst actor on the first picture. You knew he wasn't good, but you didn't notice it anymore. You know,
wow.
So that's what a good editor can do. Two, don't assume that you can't afford a good editor. Just don't do it. Figure out what budget you have for post, even if it's only $500. Put your ad up on Craigslist and let the experienced editors decide if they want to take time with you. Because experienced editors are always looking for something to do on the side. Always.
Really? So you shouldn't choose anyone that's going to editing school.
Right? No,
never,
come on.
Never under any circumstances.
Never.
No. Well, not unless you don't want your series to go anywhere.
I see. If they don't have a demo reel to show you, they don't have a demo reel, you should run, right?
Yes, exactly. If they don't have an IMDb with at least 4 or 5 hits on it, you should run.
Got it. So the ones that want to do, I'm actually about to produce a 10-minute project, and I have had several offers from a guy who wants to direct, be the cinematographer and the editor, and he has no credits. He seems guy, but I mean,
He's
nice like,
guy.
I'll do it for free. And I'm
if somebody wants to do their beginning directing, they need to do it on their own dime.
Exactly.
What they're going to do is just make a lot of mistakes.
Exactly.
I mean, look, we could spend 2 hours. I could go over, you know, a number of projects done by other directors that I've been hired to fix. Okay. I could go into the legion of mistakes people make. Somebody who has never completed on a directorial level a finished film is not someone who is even remotely capable of doing your piece.
Exactly.
What they're going to do is make every mistake in the book, you know, and you, in the end, you're going to wind up with nothing, and you will have paid for it.
Lorenda,
I mean, this is harsh, but it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody who has never flown a plane, are you going to hire them to take you from one state to another?
Well, no.
Of course not. All right. Well,
I mean, maybe they know how to fix the plane, but it doesn't know they don't mean they know how to fly it.
Right.
Exactly.
You know,
what do you feel, Lorenda, is a, because we've got 3 minutes, I want to get this in. What do you feel is a fair price that you should budget or think of to pay the editor, the DP? For short.
I mean, for a short, you know, I think you should, what's going to happen is you should figure out what your budget is and then put the ad up. You know, hopefully if it's a 2-day shoot, you've got at least $500 for a DP. That's way, way, way under market, But you know what? DPs are always looking for stuff for their reel. They're always looking for something that's well written for their reel. They're always looking for something that has good actors, because one of the things DPs in LA have a tough time doing is, you know, they're masterful DPs in this town. There's no shortage of that. But there is a shortage of high-quality projects. So they're always looking for high-quality projects. I would say for a two-day shoot, your minimum fee should be $500 or $600, and you're going to have a tough time, but there's going to be somebody who's going to write and say, let me see the script. A friend of our, I'm going to tell that tale since we don't have a lot of time. And the same thing with post-production. You know, it's the editor is probably going to spend more time on this piece
than everyone else put together.
You know, than the writer and the director put together. Maybe double that. So, you know, you should probably have at least the same amount set aside for the editor as for the DP. But put the ads up, see who responds. Some people will make counteroffers and figure out if you can deal with that.
Excellent, you know, excellent. I really appreciate that. I have a better idea now of exactly what to tell people. Great, Lorinda. Oh my God, you've been so wonderful. You're. I really appreciate that, and thank you so much, Brad. We've got 1 minute. I just want to cover the last things. Give me in 1 minute anything that you want to tell us about that's coming up, exciting, and where it's going to be, and what we can do to find it.
Oh, gee, Laurie Handel.
I think checking out customer disservice. I'm so incredibly proud and thrilled with customer disservice. It's playing on staytunedtv.com. It's just a silly little web series about two guys who are in their 40s. They're unemployed, and they get this customer service job out of their home, and it's just about how they continue to screw up their lives.
Yeah, I mean, they take calls from irate customers who are having difficulty with items that they bought from this store, and they work for the store as customer service people, and they're really a couple of complete buffoons. So they can hardly put a sentence together, let alone guide somebody through the complexities of their purchase.
Oh, my Lord. Well, let's get it out there. Stay tuned, because we got to end the show. I'm so sorry. Stay tuned, staytunedtv.com. Stay tuned.
.net.
.net. Okay, .net. Okay, so we've got to go, but gosh, thank you so much, you guys. You're welcome to come on anytime. I'm going to go check out that film right now. Customer disservice, staytunedtv.net. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Lorinda. And thank you so much, everybody. We'll see you next week on Question Reality. Bye. Say bye, Brad and Lorinda.
Bye.
Take care, Priscilla. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Question Reality.
Question Reality.
With Priscilla Leona.
Priscilla Leona.
Only on LA Talk Radio.